Penny Penny Arcade. 1, 2, 3, 4. Hello, hello, and welcome to the Paisley Penny Arcade. I am Mo. How are you doing? What's going on? How's your week going? I hope it's going well. Did you have a good week? Yeah, I had a pretty good week. Hello, Lisa in the chat room. How are you? Good to see you. Come in. Yes, I have a chat room. Those of you listening on the radio, what does that mean? What does it mean? Well, I actually have a chat room. You can come around and come to the chat room and speak to me in YouTube. It's YouTube at Mo Abdelbaki. That's all there is to it. MOABDELBAKI. And you will be whisked to the chat room. Indeed you will. And if you come in here, if you want to be on the YouTube thing, you can subscribe and you can like. Yeah, if you like, you can like and subscribe. And you can see I have Oogie Boogie sitting over here because we're getting close to Halloween. Well, it's about 3 weeks away, 3 weeks and 2 days. So might as well get into the mood. Eventually, you may see some decorating in here. Not a lot of decorating, not huge decorating, but in that theme, I forgot to put... I'm still getting used to the YouTube thing, and I'm not doing great at it. I will admit, I'm not getting great at it. I'll get it. It takes me a while to remember things, to figure out what I'm doing, and how to do it, and why to do it, and so on and so forth. But today I'm going to speak about Frankenstein, the story, what the real story is about. We've seen the green guy, you know, the big, tall Boris Karloff Frankenstein monster, the so-called monster. And he was pretty monstrous in the book, too. The book written by Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley. Wollstonecraft. Well, I'd like to talk about her a little bit. I'd like to talk about the book, and it was quite a sensational book. I mean, if you've never read the story, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating tale. Her husband, Percy Shelley, the famous poet, and Lord Byron were taking a breather out at Lake Geneva in Switzerland, and they were hanging out for an entire summer, and it was a rainy summer, so they had some time to kind of hang out and just, you know, tell ghost stories. That's what they were getting. There was a German ghost story book, and they were, I guess it was pretty good, and it enthused them to write their own stories, and so they decided to do that, and this is the story that she wrote, was the story of Frankenstein. There's some interesting things about that, and it's more than just a reanimation story. It's a lot more than that. As a matter of fact, I think it's based on social problems of the era and of the time, and it's a lot about men, as a matter of fact, and problems with men. But so let's talk about Mary Shelley a little bit. If you're interested in such things, you know, maybe you are. Hopefully you are. But this being October and heading toward, because you kids with the Frankenstein outfits on. And nothing against the great movie, you know, James Whale directed Colin Clive and Boris Karloff and, you know, Lionel Atwill and all that. And, of course, the incredible masterpiece, Bride of Frankenstein with Elsa Lancaster. And unbelievable film. She was magnificent in it. She actually played Mary Shelley in the beginning of the movie. Hello, Renee. Welcome. Come on in. Have a seat. Find a place to sit. Plenty of places to sit. It's in your imagination, so there's lots of places. But yes, indeed. She's very coquettish. Actually, they had some problems with censors in that movie for many different reasons. There were some costume problems they had, costuming, in the beginning when she was just playing Mary Shelley. And she was really something in that movie. And then there were some problems with the Bride of Frankenstein costuming. They were going to show a little breastage there, and that was like, no, you're not. You're not going to show that. So, but that's stories. I've seen some fun stills from the making of the movie where they're all sitting around having tea, and she's all wrapped up, you know. So she's having to sit on this thing. It's like a board, and she can barely bring the cup to her lips. But she imagines they're smoking cigarettes, you know. There's Karloff as a Frankenstein monster, you know, the creature, and he's smoking a cigarette along with Colin Clive as Dr. Frankenstein. He's, you know, puffing away. quite good indeed. And it's a great movie, but it's a different story than the book by Shelley, which is really quite magnificent. Let's talk a little bit about Mary Shelley, shall we? Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley, eventually. She was born the daughter of William Godwin, who was an anarchist, in England. She was born in 1797, as it were, and he was an anarchist, and a pretty devoted one at that. I don't think he was out hurling bombs or anything like that, but he was against the monarchy, and he was against classism, and was pretty devoted to the concept of everyone being equal and so on and so forth. He was very much for what happened in our country, in America. Those of you watching overseas, whatever's happening now is not what he had in mind. You know, it's not what I don't think a lot of us have in mind. But, you know, c'est dommage, right? C'est la vie. C'est la guerre, c'est la pomme de terre, as I used to say in French class, and my teacher would just go, what is wrong with you? So, at any rate, her mother was a feminist, feminist, and by God, a really strong and defiant and right out there one. Her name was Mary Wollstonecraft, and she was quite well known in her time. Although, if she had been as well known as her, I mean, she was kind of not a libertine exactly, but she didn't live by the mores of the time. She did her own thing. She was quite open in her desire to be with men and not necessarily be married to them. She had two children, and one was Mary. And she was very much a feminist. And it wasn't until this century, well, actually the last century, during the feminism movement of that time, that they really recognized how important she was to the movement. And she died 11 days after Mary Shelley was born. So Mary was quite taken with her work, which she only got to know, of course, posthumously after her mom died, not after Mary died, of course. And so that became a very big part of her upbringing. It became a very big part of who she was. It's kind of an amazing thing. Powerful. Let's see. She says, I read Frankenstein in college English class. This is Renee saying. And had to write an essay on the book. I can't remember what I wrote. A long time ago. Yeah, college was, trust me, a long time ago for me. And but it's a book I've read a few times because it is not at all what I expected. Actually, the first time I read it, I was probably 12 or 13. I read it after Dracula and was totally just floored by it. Because it was not at all what I expected. I expected, fire, bad, that whole thing with Igor and the, whipping the monster and him getting loose and the old man who played the violin. And, I mean, I expected the trope. I expected the whole thing with throwing the little girl in the pond and none of that was in there. Some aspects of it, I suppose. But that was Hollywood. That was not at all what was in the book. And here's why. Because what Mary Shelley wrote was, let's start with what the times were about. First of all, in England, and probably in France, because Mary's mom went to the French Revolution. She really did. She went to the French Revolution. She went to France about a week or so before King Louis was guillotined. And she wanted to be there in the midst of the excitement of the revolution itself, because she thought things were going to be so much better. She was into the whole aspect of freedom to the people, vive la révolution, the whole thing. And, of course, she got there, and then the Reign of Terror started, Robespierre and all that sort of thing. And, the Jacobite movement was so chaotic. And at a certain point there, they were turning on British revolutionaries who were there, and they were actually taking them and doing bad things to them as well. So she had to take off and went back to England, and that's when she met Mary's father, Godwin, William Godwin, and they got together and had a baby, and then she died. Boom. And so, but at that time in England, it was a very stuffy sort of, and it stayed that way for a long time, and then Victoria became queen, and then we had the Victorian era, but it was still pretty, it was pretty tough stuff. It had been George and Mad King George and so on and so forth. And so, but there was a problem with crime. There was a lot of crime. And the crime was pretty rough. In 1751, the Murder Act of 1751. The Murder Act of 1751 said that if you committed murder, that your body, once you were executed, could be used for medical experiments. Imagine that. So you've done some horrendous crime. And so because you've done that, part of the punishment was they got to use your body to do experiments. And one of the things that was being done was electricity. What was his name? Antonio, I don't know, Galvan. He was Italian, and he was, doing things with frog legs and electricity. He'd put the electricity through with batteries through frog legs, and they would kick. And so his nephew, is he Giuseppe? I think it was Giuseppe Galvan. I don't remember. It's been a while. He would do it on oxen that had been, and he would put it on their bodies after they were gone, and they would convulse because electrical, jolts would make the bodies convulse. Well, people started doing it to human bodies. And they would do things like they'd put them on their, you know, faces, and the faces would grimace and smile, and the bodies would jerk and convulse and all that stuff. Well, it was pure nerve reaction in the bodies. Well, this started an entire scientific discussion about the reanimation of life. Huge big deal. Huge big deal. And as a matter of fact, some of these scientists would take corpses around and do shows for scientific benefit of the public. And people would come into these theaters, these surgical theaters, and they would watch this, and they would take these, and they would charge them money to watch them do this stuff. And they'd hook them up, and the bodies would, you know, they would look like they were breathing or gasping, and some of them would sit up, and, you know, they'd do all these horrible things to these poor corpses, whatever. And so there was this whole huge medical argument that started about, should we do this? Should we reanimate life? And what are the implications of doing so? If we bring back somebody from the dead, what if we create a body, you know, from different body parts, and we bring them back? Who are they? Well, nowadays, you know, we've got organ donation, and we've got this and a little bit of that and a tincture of this, and, you know, and now we have IVF and everything, which is a miracle, and actually, I think, a rather good thing, because we have families now that wouldn't have children, and they're what a blessing they are. You know, we've got these wonderful families, but the question they had was, this is an important question for our discussion today. Would someone who had lived and died, if we managed to create somebody and give them a good zap and bring them back to life, would that person have a soul? Or is it only God, whatever that is, who can create a soul? Because if you create somebody that does not have a soul, will they have a conscience? Will they be able to be decent? This was a huge, huge argument. I mean, this was, you know, I mean, it was really a big deal. And it's certainly one that, I mean, we're still arguing today about all sorts of things. You know, vaccine, to vaccine or not to vaccine, or vaccinate. I guess there is a verb. I mean, this is an amazing thing that's going on today, that there are still some remarkable conversations going on about this or that, Tylenol or not to Tylenol, you know. It's phenomenal. So that was a big one during the time. Was there a soul or was there? There were people trying to measure the soul. I know they're still doing that today. You know, some people claim they've done it. So this was a biggie at the time. Very, very big. And so it was spooky. It was like, well, this is the very edge of science. The very edge. Scary stuff. And morally, it was a huge big deal. Do we dare do such a thing? What if we do it? What is our responsibility? Now, another problem was that men, especially wealthy men, but not limited to wealthy men had a habit of fathering children without taking responsibility for them. Just boom, 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 boom. I'm going to have a kid, 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 I'm going to have a kid. And wealthy men, what they would do is they would visit prostitutes and they would get them pregnant sometimes, you know, and they would absolutely take no responsibility for them. And it ended badly. Venereal disease was a huge issue, and often deadly. I mean, really quite bad. And these people became a pariah upon society. A really bad thing, because most often, Oliver Twist is a good example of that. Orphans, street urchins under the tutelage of Fagin, who was a rat, you know, ostensibly taking care of these young children, when in fact he's not such a good guy, you know, not such a good guy. But you look at this underworld, this underbelly of society, and one of the major problems is men who do not take responsibility for their actions. Action, reaction. Action, consequence. And that is a main theme throughout the novel. Action, consequence. Hence the subtitle of the book, The Modern Prometheus. Now, therein lies an interesting concept. I love mythology. I'm a real mythology freak. And the story of Prometheus is a good one. Prometheus is a demigod. A demigod. And as such, he's part human and part god. Half and half, right? And he looks at humans and says, these poor people, they don't have the one thing that can help them more than anything else, and that's fire. Fire is a necessity for civilization. And he's just weeping, I don't want to put words in his mouth. But so what he does, and Zeus owns lightning and thus owns fire. It's his. He owns the lightning bolt. Now, Hephaestus makes those bolts for him in Etna, Mount Etna, and hands them over when he wants them, or Vesuvius, depending on Rome or Greek. But he hands them over to him. But those are his. And what happens is that Prometheus, he steals fire. He hides it in his thigh. Doesn't matter where he really puts it. And he brings it to humans. And Zeus flips out. Because that's his. He owns fire. It's all his. So he punishes Prometheus. And the way he does this is he takes him to the top of a mountain. Mount Io? No, what is it? It doesn't matter. And he chains him to the top of the mountain for an eternity, and he sicks either a vulture or an eagle upon him to pick out his liver every single day during the day, where it literally tears him open and eats his liver every single day, and then at night it heals, which is fascinating because the liver will heal itself, right? I love that. That's a great myth. And it tells you something about the concept of the liver, which is they knew that the liver did regrow itself. And you wonder, how did they know that? You know? Well, I'm sure they knew it through many different ways. But so every night his liver regenerated itself. And the next day, once again, the eagle would come down, because the eagle was the bird of Zeus. But it could be a vulture too, which is kind of horrifying. But come down, it would tear him open again and pick at his liver throughout the day. Agony, the agony he felt, and that was his penance. Action, consequence. Until eventually Hercules frees him from this agony. Now, why is this important? Because we'll get to that. We'll get to that. So you realize that this whole thing is about society. Frankenstein is about, really about, I think, about men to one extent. Because men don't think about what they do. The story is about Victor Frankenstein. He goes to school to well, to become a doctor, essentially. And he becomes completely caught up in the idea of creating life. He gets the idea in his head that he can do it. It isn't until the book was published in 1818, and it isn't until 1831 that that publication that the idea of galvanism, electricity, is put into it. So it really isn't put in there in the first edition, this idea of the lightning and, you know, it's alive, you know, that doesn't come in right away. As a matter of fact, in that first publication, he doesn't put forth any concept. As a matter of fact, here's how the story goes. It starts off as a few letters by a guy named Walton, who is a captain on a ship, writing to his sister Martha. I met this guy in the North Pole. He was, you know, and he told me this story. And the story is he's chasing this thing that he created and blah, blah, blah. I'm paraphrasing. But it's basically Victor Frankenstein talking about this thing he created. And he's trying to track him down and destroy him. That's his job. And so you go, oh, okay. And he tells the story to the captain, and he's exhausted and almost dead. I mean, he's just, you know, he's not in great shape at all. And the story is horrific. Horrific. Because, I mean, I don't want to spoil the book for you if you're going to read it. And, you know, but essentially what has happened is that he just says on a dreary November evening, I created life. That's it. I mean, there's really no description about how he does it. And I love that. Because it's like, it doesn't matter how I did it. I'm not going to tell you what I did. Because it really has no bearing on anything. And yet in the movie, you know, that's the big, you know, all that thing. And it's fantastic. It's fantastic movie. It's great cinema. But it really has no bearing in the story. Because the movie is all wonderful stuff, but the book is about revenge. That's what the book is all about. It's about revenge. And there's a real moral to that story. Frankenstein becomes absolutely obsessed with the idea of creating life. And he figures out how to do it. He comes up with the way to do it, how to do it. And so he visits charnel houses. And we're not too familiar with the term now, because thank goodness we don't do them, we don't have them. But it used to be common practice to just have places where you threw bodies, you know, old bodies, new bodies. And because of the work, it was so delicate, he has to make this thing really big. So he can attach things. And he creates this perfect creature, but he's 8 feet tall because he has to make him so big so he can attach the vessels, and he has to reattach everything. And he makes a perfectly working creature, right? But he's grotesque. The skin barely covers the muscles. I love that. I mean, and you're thinking to yourself, wow, she was amazing. And supposedly, maybe Percy Shelley, her husband, the poet, helped her with some of this later on. But there's no real proof here or there. Or maybe someone has finally gotten it. I don't know. It doesn't matter. What an imagination she had. What an amazing grasp. So this guy, and here's a very important part of the story. So he suddenly, and oh, welcome to the chat room. Oh, you're always welcome. Late is not a problem, you know. That's not a problem. It's so good to see you. So here's what happens. He thinks he does it. The thing starts breathing, and he goes into kind of a, you know, like a Shemp Three Stooges thing, me, 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 me. And he goes in into his room and just kind of goes into a kind of a fit. He tries to get some sleep because he hasn't slept in weeks. And this thing is grotesque. 8 feet tall, yellow skin, not green, but yellow. And I know the yellow he's talking about because I grew up in an anatomy department. My dad was a professor of veterinary surgical anatomy, and they had human cadavers in that anatomy department too, and lots and lots of jars of things that I don't want to talk about. But I saw them from the time I was 4 all the way to when I was all grown up. And a lot of those jars had very old specimens in them, and they were a very specific color of yellow. And that's what she's talking about, is that color of yellow. I know the color, and his eyes were yellow in the book. So it's not the Boris Karloff green. The reason they chose that color green was because they wanted it to be a pale grayish color that would look like she talks about in the book, that yellowish kind of grayish color. But I know exactly the color they're talking about, and ew. So anyway, so he's this horribly grotesque looking thing that people are going to freak out when they see, with long hair, you know, long hippie like hair. Boy, I know that feeling. Being stared at for that. And so he freaks out. And he goes to his room and he has to try and get his, you know, but he can't sleep. And then he finally does fall asleep in a fit, so to speak. And he opens his eyes and there is his creation standing over him, grinning at him like, Daddy, you know, Daddy. And he completely loses it. And he runs away as fast as he can. And he just leaves this poor creature who has just awakened from death into life, sprung from death to life. The ancient Egyptians called Osiris, who was reborn from death into life, the leaper, right? The springer, but springing from death to life. So they represented him as a hare, not like, you know, not hare, a rabbit, a hare, the leaper. I love that. You know, it's such a remarkable image. So he comes to life, and he comes up, and he's looking for his father. He's looking for something, for someone. He's brand new to life. He doesn't know anything. His brain is completely erased. He's brand new. He's born like we are born. What Freud called polymorphous perversity, and what Freud wouldn't write about polymorphous perversity for another, what, 40, 50 years? Maybe longer. She writes about in this book. With the monster, not monster, the creature. It's not a monster. Well, he is a monster later, but about saying that everything, sound, sight, touch, everything was the same. He couldn't separate it. This is what Freud calls polymorphous perversity. How did she know this? What a remarkable thing. She was so brilliant. So incredibly brilliant. So, and Frankenstein books it. And he has like a nervous breakdown, right? I don't want anything to do with this child. This 8 foot tall child. 8 feet tall, that's big. That's bigger than Shaquille O'Neal. And so then, basically, he tells this story about how he just kind of, you know, went away and found a place and hunkered down and went back to his studies. With this thing roaming around. And then he gets a letter that his cousin has been, or his nephew, or his little brother, I can't remember, has died. Murdered. Wow. And things begin to happen. And the people that he loves are being killed. Well, His liver is being torn out. The monster, who started out, maybe could have been okay, you know? But because he was neglected, left on the streets to fend for himself, hideous, and knew that he was hideous because he saw his own face in the mirror and he scared himself and he knew that he was indeed terrifying and that people would not accept him. You see, this is what happened. And so rather than being encouraged and loved and raised, and this, by the way, the creature is eloquent. He teaches himself to read. He teaches himself to write. He speaks more than one language. I think there's a part in it where he actually ends up watching a Muslim family and he learns Arabic. I mean, it's phenomenal. He's got a brain that is like a sponge. And he learns so much about people. He falls in love with a family where they play music and they sing. And he falls in love with them. But they catch sight of him and they shoot him. I mean, it's heartrending. He just wants to be, you know what he misses in his life? You know what's missing from his life? Love. He has no love. And I think that's one of the main aspects of the story, is that without love, we become feral and we become dangerous. I've met people without love, and I'm sure you have too. And love is maybe the most important thing that we have to give anybody, anything. If you give love, if you reach out and you bring someone close and you hold them and you love them energetically or physically and you just love them and give them your honest, true love and you mean it and they know it, it changes them. It may not change them completely. The damage may be done. But true love, genuine love, there's nothing like it. I was talking about Dracula last week. What is it that Dracula gives his, well, immortality, right? But he offers them something that appears to be love. It isn't love. Not really. But it's appealing and it's erotic. That's why the story is so, you know, what it is. Because, and it's power. It's power dressed up as love. It's power dressed up as something else, really. You know? I've lost a lot of people that I love in this life. A lot of people that I truly have loved in this life. It's a part of life. If you love, you will lose that love. But I'm always willing to love more. I'm always willing to love often. And it seems ridiculous not to open yourself up to that. This doctor, Frankenstein, he created not because he was thinking about loving it, but just to see if he could do it. And when he did it, he was horrified and instantly remorseful and regretful. And this poor being, he didn't ask to be created, just like these people on the streets of any city, anywhere in the world, who are unloved and unwanted. What do? They become a tribe. I felt, what the heck? I felt pretty unloved. conditionally loved at times, but unloved for a period of my life when I was at my freakiest during the whole so-called hippie freaky era, because I did not fit into the mold that I was supposed to be in. Just wasn't. I wasn't the good, neatly groomed, obedient kid. I was this. I haven't had a haircut in, what, 10, 11 months? I don't know. It's been a while. Yeah, it's well over a year. It's been well over a year. But back then it had been quite a while. And I was telling someone today about my five of discs worry. It's 42 cents, five discs, five coins in my hand. That's how I drew the card. And because I had been kicked out of the house. And I went to, we were living in Palo Alto, and I ended up in San Francisco, and it was cold. It was November, and it was really cold. And I didn't have much coat, and it was just a few years after the Summer of Love, and I walked into a little shop, and I hadn't eaten since the night before, and I was cold, and I was shivering, and I was 18, young. I was just a kid. And this lady didn't like me, you know, hair. And I just was hungry. And there was a bag of chips. And I asked her how much bag of chips. She said 50 cents. Which seems high now that I think about it. But all I had was 42 cents. A quarter, a dime, a nickel, and 2 pennies. 5 pennies. Or five coins. And she had one of those things, take a penny, leave a penny. And it was full of pennies, you know. So I took 7 of them and said, please. And she grabbed all the money out of my hand and take the chips. She was Chinese. And you got out. So I got out. And I felt like a creature. Streets were almost deserted. And I you just wonder what you're going to do. And you feel like a creature, you know? And I thought about that story that I'd read more than once. And you think about what you're going to do. Well, what I did was not what the monster, what the creature would have done. I went to a payphone and called my parents and said, can you come get me, please? And they did, because they did love me. That's the difference. There it is. I found it. That was the difference. And that is the difference. Not everyone has that. I was blessed and I was lucky. Not everyone has that. So in a society like what existed there, there were children who didn't have that option. Man, I had some really strange encounters. I'll tell you about some of them sometime, not today. I'm pretty lucky to be here, to be quite honest with you. I had some very dangerous encounters. Very dangerous. I hitchhiked in the 70s. Hitchhiked across states. And I'm still here, and I'm very, very happy and blessed to be here. Thank you. I was watched over, for sure. So anyway, get that maudlin stuff out of the way. It's the impulsiveness of, and I think because of her feminist views, that Mary Shelley was saying men are rash. And men do things that they don't think about. In the moment, they react. or they react, and they do their impulsive stuff, and then they have to pay for it. And the creature, this poor creature, maybe without a soul, I don't know. He does show some remorse, supposedly, but I don't know if it's real, because he just keeps right on killing everyone that Frankenstein knows and loves. Destroying his life, destroying his world. That's what the book is about. It's about revenge. It's about the hollowness of it, because never does the creature feel any better. It doesn't help him. It's this hollow thing that he does. It never helps him. It never makes him feel any better. It never... When do we ever help ourselves by hurting someone else? Never. Never. It's completely hollow. And I think that's a big part of the story. It's compelling. It shows the absolute ridiculous nature of vengeance. This creature did not want to be created, despised its creation, despised its existence, never found a single moment of joy. And when Frankenstein finally dies, he weeps over him because his father is dead, whom he loves. He loves. So it's an incredible tale of conflicted feelings, you know? It hit me hard in many ways, in many places. I always got along well with my dad. He kind of accepted me as I was. At the height of my weird look, he always said I looked like Rasputin, as he called me, Rasputin. I'd wear that black hat above me, that big black Tom Mix hat, and he'd say, "You look like Rasputin." And and we got along. But then I realized later that for the entire time, I would say probably a 5-year period, he didn't take a single picture of me. Not one. And it freaked me out, because he took pictures all the time of everybody else, but he didn't take a picture of me like that in my freakiest times. My sister, who is an angel on this earth, who is a really remarkable human being, I like her, in case you couldn't tell, she swears she has a picture of me during my real out of this world period, and I'm betting she doesn't. And I don't know why he didn't, because I never got the impression, I was pretty far out, I will admit that. I mean, I once went to an army surplus store and bought a gas mask with a canister, and I wore it for some bizarre reason for a while. I'd go around wearing a gas mask. I was out there. I was really searching for something. And then you find yourself, you know. And then I moved to the South, where if I'd worn my hair down like that, the way it was, it was very ethnic, I'll put it that way, it would have been bad for me. And maybe that's what the story is about, finding yourself. Or not acting rashly. That's really what it's about. Not everything is about my search for myself. But it's a remarkable tale, and worth reading. I mean, I don't think I spoiled it for you, since the story is, you know, well, 1818. It's been a while. Almost 200 years old. The creature is remarkably eloquent. He doesn't, you know, he loves fire. When he finds fire, he loves it, because it keeps him warm, because he's cold. it keeps him warm, and he learns to love fire and how to build fire. I think he eventually learns how to build fire. But you feel for him, and you realize that you begin to kind of hate. I actually, Walton comes to view him as a friend. I never view Victor as a friend. I view him as not a great guy because of what he did, because he abandoned his son, essentially. He created him. It's his son. I can't look at him any other way. I just can't. You can't do that. You can't walk away, run away from your responsibilities. I just don't think you can. That's how I feel about it. Maybe I'm naive. No matter who they are, no matter, you know, even if they don't look like you, you just don't do that. You embrace them. You teach them. Teach your children. The song Teach Your Children by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. By the way, steel guitar on that is Jerry Garcia. Not all of you know who Jerry Garcia was. He was the guitarist for the Grateful Dead and singer. And lovely guy. The Grateful Dead, by the way, had kind of a fixation on Saint Stephen. And it took me all this time to realize, I think, what that was about. Most deadheads don't know what St. Stephen. Why St. Stephen? Why St. Stephen? I think I know why, and I'm going to tell you why. Because St. Stephen was stoned to death. And I think that's why. Does that make sense? Because he was stoned? I think so. I could be wrong, but I think so. Jerry's funeral was in St. Stephen's Church in the Bay Area, so... He was a sweet guy, laid back. We create our own creatures, and we're responsible for them. And that's the key. And when we create them, we can't abandon them. They will always wreak their vengeance. So I think that the book is about responsibility. And we have to always remember that we can't run away from them. We create what we create. And each Frankenstein spends the last part of his life chasing the monster. And he is a monster at that point, because the things he does are monstrous. And they are horrible things, just to get back at Victor. It's a sad story, but it's brilliant, and it's insightful, and it's remarkable, and it's written by a genius woman who is a feminist and I think an anarchist, because Percy Shelley was an anarchist too. That's how he met her. He was a devotee of her father's. So there we are. That is my take on Frankenstein. And the movie's fun. I love the movie. I love The Bride of Frankenstein even more. I think Elsa Lancaster was... I don't think it was Lancaster. I think it was Lancaster. She was married, of course, to Charles Laughton. And quite an interesting marriage, I'm sure. But she was wonderful in that movie. My God. She's just incredible in that film. If you've not seen The Bride of Frankenstein, Whale's direction of it is nothing short of absolute sheer screaming genius. You know? And Colin Clive as Frankenstein, Henry Frankenstein, and they changed the name. Probably a little bit too German for them. But it's a very deep psychological story with social implications that are vast. It's fun. If you like head tails, if you like head trips. So that's that. And that's, man, stories like that are kind of amazing. They really are. So I don't know what we'll do next week. I'll think about it. And we'll come up with something, you know. Hopefully it'll be, I'll think of something. But for now, that's my time. And I just want to wish you all a wonderful week. And of course, peace and love. I'll talk to you later, okay?
Bye-bye. Until next we meet, I'll be waiting for you right here in the Paisley Penny Arcade.